This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. TriMet has announced that a glitch in its ticket machines, or TVMs, have caused thousands of riders' credit or debit cards to be erroneously frozen over the past 5 years. Such riders saw security fraud freezes placed on their credit or debit cards by their banks after using TriMet ticket machines. TriMet says that the problem caused up to 2,500 cards to be frozen per month over the five-year period, and that after its recent discovery and correction in January, the rate of occurrence dropped from 4% to less than 0.5%. Credit or debit card purchases make up for over half of TriMet ticket purchases. Previously, TriMet had placed the blame for the problem on banks' sensitivity to a black market for TriMet tickets, which, according to police, sees individuals buying tickets with stolen cards and selling them for cheap at stations. While TriMet has flouted a 90% reliability rate of its machines, this is low in comparison to other regional transit systems, such as Bay Area Rapid Transit or SmartCar. Earlier this week, TriMet put out a news release addressing the problem of faulty TVMs, in which they said they were working towards a system that would significantly reduce reliance on the machines. It also says that over half of their TVMs will have been replaced with new machines by July of this year. Meanwhile, if a customer encounters a broken machine, the document suggests they try using another machine nearby or consider buying advance tickets in the future.
Earlier today, the Oregon State Senate repassed House Bill 2896, which prohibits teenagers under the age of 18 from using tanning bed facilities without a note from a physician. The bill was sponsored by Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward. In early March, the Oregon House passed the bill, but later the Senate decided to allow 17-year-olds to use commercial tanning beds with parental consent. The House did not concur with this amendment and brought the bill back in its original form to the Senate this morning, where it passed. KBOO's Audrey Davis has more on the story.
Advocates of the bill argue that 17-year-olds are the highest users of tanning beds under the age of 18. Supporters also note that the FDA classified commercial tanning beds as a level 1 carcinogen, putting it in the same category as tobacco and arsenic. Senator Tim Knopp claims that the bill will only put children in more danger.
Well, teenagers are going to continue to tan, colleagues. They're just not going to do it in a regulated place. They're going to do it with a tanning bed from the 1990s that costs them $150. If we're serious about this issue, we need to educate and enforce.
Senator Fred Girard argues that the power to grant permission should remain in the hands of the parent rather than the physician.
Now we say, physicians, this is a great group to be the gatekeeper. And probably up until, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I'd have said that's absolutely true. However, we did the same thing with medical marijuana. We were told that this was only going to be a couple hundred scripts, and it has just skyrocketed. In my district, one physician wrote 6,000 scripts, $200 a script, $1,000,002. So who's going to be the gatekeeper, a parent who really cares and will really sit on their kid, or a physician that has every reason to write a prescription? There's acne, there's vitamin D, there's depression. All those could be reasons to write the script, and somebody's going to make a ton of money off this, and it's just not right.
While both sides agreed on the central issue of the bill, supporters note that parents do not have the proper education to keep their children out of harm from tanning. Senator Alan Bates spoke this morning in favor of the bill.
There are issues here where parents don't take the proper care of their kids. That's a fact. They don't understand what we've been taught in medicine, that certain people of certain skin types especially shouldn't be exposed to ultraviolet, either in the sun or in tanning booths. They don't understand. They don't know that. It's not common knowledge. And to get them educated is going to take a long, long, long time.
Senator Steiner Hayward and carrier of the bill concluded the discussion with this statement.
Parents have not been well educated. They're not taking responsibility. When 32% of high school senior girls are using tanning beds, parents aren't doing their job. But ultimately, it's true. We didn't have the data about the clear data about the role of tanning beds and of early UV radiation in the development of melanoma when the original regulations were passed. We have new data. As my colleague from District 28 mentioned, we changed in medicine how we treat ulcers because we got new data. It's our obligation to pay attention to the latest scientific data, to do our best to ensure its validity, and then to act appropriately. And that's what we're doing with this bill.
Ultimately, the bill passed and will now go to the governor for his signature. For KBOO News, I'm Audrey Davis.
Cutting the city of Portland's mounted police patrol may save more than the $1 million listed in Mayor Hales' proposed budget. The training site for the horses in the mounted patrol is located on a coveted waterfront property which is leased to the city for $1 a year. But the Portland Development Commission, which owns the site, says that it is worth over $9 million. With the cancellation of the mounted patrol, the PDC will be able to sell the property to the Schnitzer family for a housing development. The 9 horses in the mounted patrol will also probably be sold to private owners. The Portland Development Commission says that even if the mounted patrol is preserved, the horses will have to be moved as part of a plan to restore an aging flour mill located on the site.
In Sherwood, earlier this week, an overflow crowd packed a city council meeting to oppose the construction of a Walmart superstore in this growing town southwest of Portland. Most of the public comment period in Tuesday's meeting focused on the Walmart superstore, with residents voicing concerns about the closure of local businesses and increased traffic congestion due to the planned Walmart. The store was approved on May 6th by the City Council, and the company plans to begin construction of the superstore in June. In addition to concerns about the impact of the Walmart, that the Walmart will have on Sherwood's small town feel, residents also criticized the City Council for making the decision so quickly without community input. 4 years ago, the Walmart Corporation admitted to having developed a plan to construct 17 Walmart stores in the Portland area. Local businesses and residents who are opposed to what they call a takeover by the retail giant have organized campaigns against some of the stores. While a planned big box store in Jansen Beach was canceled, the company has been able to move forward with 6 stores that it calls neighborhood markets. These are about one-fourth the size of a traditional Walmart superstore, and they are being constructed in urban rather than suburban settings. Currently underway are Walmart stores in West Lynn, in Gresham, Oregon City, in Lake Oswego, and in Beaverton. As for the Walmart Supercenter in Sherwood, the City Council decided to move ahead with the project despite the community opposition expressed at Tuesday's City Council meeting.
Liberal advocates, state leaders, and public employee unions across the nation are up in arms amid rumors that conservative billionaires David H. and Charles G. Koch might purchase the Tribune family of newspapers. The Tribune's holdings include the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune, plus 6 additional newspapers. Opponents say the purchase would threaten press freedom by putting 2 major papers of record into the hands of staunch conservatives. The Koch brothers, heirs to an oil fortune, have gained fame in recent years for their heavy-handed financing of conservative causes. Although the brothers have neither confirmed nor denied the rumors, nationwide opposition to the sale is quickly gaining steam. Protests, signature-gathering efforts, and online ads are cropping up across the country, especially in Los Angeles and Chicago. State leaders are also rallying to the cause. California State Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg told the New York Times that he opposed the purchase. The brothers have a long and demonstrated history of rigid political ideology, Steinberg said. The rumors are also sounding alarm bells for public employee unions concerned over the future of pension funds. The Tribune's largest shareholder is Oaktree Capital Management, which keeps a quarter of its holdings in public pension funds. In a letter to the Oaktree president and Tribune chairman, Bruce Karsh, 10 public employee unions threatened to pull the funds from Oaktree if the sale went through. The unions described the Koch brothers as anti-labor, anti-environment, anti-public education, and anti-immigrant. Selling the Tribune papers to the brothers is akin to selling a car to a buyer who plans to run you over, they added. Liberal advocacy group The Courage Campaign is funding ads on the websites of both newspapers and gathering signatures for an open letter to Tribune Company. The Koch brothers would use the papers to further a radical right-wing agenda, the Institute says. Half of the Los Angeles Times staff has threatened to quit if the sale goes through.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Telecom Wawa at 6, featuring Native American music, news, and other info pertinent to the Native community. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a Hip-Hop Perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high near 82 degrees. Tomorrow night will become partly cloudy with lows dropping to around 55 degrees.
It's 5:15, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Sometimes corporate greed flares with such intensity that it ignites public outrage. This happened in April when an 8-story, recklessly built clothing factory in Dhaka, Bangladesh, crashed. Hundreds of workers were crushed by slabs of concrete, having been ordered by the ruthless factory owner to continue working, even though the structure's collapse was imminent. Public rage at such scorn for the value of workers' lives led to mass protests across the country and the jailing of the owner. Good. But what about his equally culpable cohorts? The CEOs of Walmart, Gap, and other retailing behemoths who've instilled this culture of greed throughout their global supply chain. They've dictated a corporate order that compels shortcuts on safety and rewards unscrupulous factory owners. Walmart and other major clothing marketers surged into Bangladesh in recent years specifically because it has the world's cheapest, least protected laborers. Corporate bosses know that Bangladeshi factories are hell holes where nightmares constantly come true. Less than 6 months ago, a horrific fire in another factory in this same city killed 112 workers who were making clothing for these same giants. Walmart subsequently responded by pledging zero tolerance for such haphazard manufacturing, loudly launching a $1.6 million worker safety academy in Bangladesh, and blah, blah, blah. It was pure, disgraceful PR bull stuff, and it changed nothing. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, Walmart refuses to sign a legally binding fire and building safety agreement put forth by labor advocates. It would require the profiteers to make all their factories safe, open each one to independent inspectors, and stop their senseless tolerance for the serial killing of garment workers. For information on this agreement, go to workersrights.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Federal Reserve has announced that nearly 100,000 homeowners who were victims of fraud by Wall Street banks have again been shortchanged by their mortgage lenders. The homeowners were due to receive settlement payments after the Federal Reserve found that their mortgage lenders improperly foreclosed on them. In many cases, the lenders engaged in outright fraud to strip them of their homes. Over 4 million homeowners are scheduled to receive checks as part of the settlement, but 96,000 customers of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley received less money than they were supposed to. Alan Fisher with Al Jazeera has more on this story.
The crash in the U.S. housing market was one of the key factors in the global financial meltdown. Across the U.S., banks worried people wouldn't be able to pay their mortgage began to foreclose on home loans. Thousands were thrown onto the street. Now the banks are essentially admitting they mishandled the process by skipping steps and not going through the paperwork properly. They also rarely offer people the chance to change the terms of their loan. Now they will have to pay $8.5 billion in compensation. The banks had been ordered by regulators to carry out a review of all their foreclosures in 2011. This settlement ends that process. People who were on the wrong end of the bank's decision could receive anything from $1,000 to $125,000. People whose homes were unfairly seized and sold will get the bigger payments. It's thought 3.8 million people have been affected. Critics say the deal allows the banks to escape responsibility for damages that could have cost them much, much more, perhaps hundreds of billions of dollars. The deal also allows the banks to post much better than expected results in their next set of financial figures. That should help their share price. The US Congress has asked regulators for a full briefing on the proposed settlement before the end of the week. Alan Fisher, Al Jazeera, Washington.
Housing lender Fannie Mae reported record profits this quarter, earning nearly $60 billion since January. Fannie Mae used tax credits from the bad loans it absorbed to increase its profits. A federal policy dictates that profits over $3 billion a quarter will have to go back to the U.S. government to pay back the bailout that occurred in 2008. The company's net worth of $64 billion will mean a dividend of close to $60 billion to the U.S. Treasury. The lender says that higher credit ratings are required for homebuyers now, and the recovering housing market is also a factor in the new housing boom. But despite the recent boom in home construction, many of the newly constructed homes around the country remain empty. Employment rates have not kept pace with the construction boom, and many former homeowners and potential homeowners remain priced out of the housing market, unable to afford a new home.
Senate Republicans used a rarely invoked formality to stall the confirmation of Thomas Perez to the cabinet position of Labor Secretary. The Rule Committee says that the Senate can't start a meeting more than 2 hours after the Senate floor sessions start for the day. Even though the caucus was granted more time, Republicans used procedural roadblocks to delay the confirmation. The date of confirmation has been pushed back another week to May 18th. If confirmed, Perez would be the only Latino member of Obama's cabinet. Senate Republicans opposed the confirmation, accusing Perez of holding far-left views. But little evidence has been provided to support this claim. During Obama's first administration, Perez headed the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. In that position, he oversaw the settlement of the three largest fair lending cases in U.S. history on behalf of families targeted by unfair mortgage lending practices.
In another attempt to block Obama's cabinet nominees, Republicans today stopped a committee vote on the president's pick to head the EPA. The Senate Republicans claimed that nominee Gina McCarthy was unresponsive when she failed to provide answers to all of the 1,000 written questions that they had submitted to the nominee. They boycotted the committee meeting, leaving Democrats without the majority required to confirm the EPA head. Democratic Senator Harry Reid accused Republicans of engaging in an unacceptable pattern of procedural roadblocks to prevent the administration from getting work done. Nearly 5 months after his second inauguration, a number of cabinet positions have not yet been filled, mainly due to stalling tactics by Senate Republicans.
The Environmental Protection Agency has approved the use of a new insecticide developed by Dow Chemical Company, despite concerns about its impact on bee populations. The EPA classified the pesticide sulfoxaflor as highly toxic to honeybees, but says that it has established regulations that will help prevent these negative effects. But nonprofit organizations working to eliminate the use of pesticides argue that these regulations are not sufficient to protect the dying bee population. A spokesperson for the agency says that they decided to approve the pesticide because it could help eradicate insects that have developed resistance to other pesticides. Following multiple studies linking bee colony collapse with pesticide usage, the European Union last week voted to restrict the use of three types of pesticide. But the U.S. government, in its most recent report on the topic, ignored the multiple scientific studies and focused instead on presentations at conferences. The report by the U.S. Department of Agriculture stated that there are multiple causes for bee colony collapse and did not recommend the restrictions of any pesticides. According to a recent study conducted by the Bee Informed Partnership, the Apiary Inspectors of America, and the United States Department of Agriculture, beekeepers lost an average of 45% of their colonies last winter. Beekeepers in the United States warn that unless certain pesticides are restricted, bee colony collapse could result in the eradication of honeybees, the world's most essential pollinator, within the next few years.
Shell announced this week that it will move forward with plans to create the world's deepest offshore oil well in the Gulf of Mexico. As onshore oil wells dry up, companies like Royal Dutch Shell and ExxonMobil are resorting to ever riskier means of procuring barrels of crude oil. Beginning in 2016, Shell will drill almost 2 miles down to hit on a payload of untapped Gulf oil reserves. The project tracks an industry-wide trend of deeper and riskier offshore initiatives that aim to extract oil from previously unreachable underwater wells. Oil from wells at least 4,500 feet below the surface accounted for half of the oil discovered during the first half of 2012, according to Reuters. Shell is already drilling as deep as 9,500 feet in its existing Gulf oil fields. ExxonMobil also announced this week a $4 billion deepwater development project in the Julia oil field, located in the Gulf's deepest waters. Oil companies say that deepwater drilling is the key to meeting global oil demand, but a string of accidents have led many people to question the wisdom of these riskier technologies. In April 2010, an explosion on BP's Deepwater Horizon rig killed 11 and unleashed a gusher that leaked 200 million barrels of sticky, toxic crude before it was sealed. BP appears to be taking a step back from the latest deepwater initiatives. Citing increasing costs and a tough market, the company pulled the plug last month on its largest Gulf oil project. But Shell Oil will press ahead with deep drilling initiatives despite the risks, according to the company executives. Shell says that the company is committed to increasing oil production in the Americas to meet growing U.S. energy demands. The new oil well is expected to render 2 billion barrels of oil equivalent and will produce up to 50,000 barrels of oil daily. Safety procedures demanded by some public officials after the BP oil spill 3 years ago have not been put into effect, mainly due to lobbying efforts by the oil industry.
According to a recently published report entitled Unburnable Carbon 2013, Wasted Capital and Stranded Assets, two-thirds of the world's fossil fuels should remain unused in order to maintain a 2 degrees Celsius limitation to prevent destructive climate change. The report was written and distributed by climate change nonprofit Carbon Tracker in conjunction with London's Grantham Research Institute. The financial establishment recognizes the fossil fuel reserves as assets. This leads to the idea of profits to be made, as opposed to finding a more sustainable method to fuel the carbon-based infrastructure. In the next decade, carbon-based energy companies hope to invest $6 trillion to create reserves of oil, coal, and gas that can be extracted economically.
With the issue of military sexual assault in the national spotlight this week, new reports reveal details of an Air Force brochure distributed in South Carolina that instructs potential victims of sexual assault to submit to their attackers under certain circumstances. The brochure, publicized in a recent Wired magazine article, was released by the group Protect Our Defenders, an advocacy group fighting military sexual assault. The brochure is aimed at risk reduction for service members who could be potentially targeted for rape or assault. It claims that under certain circumstances, particularly when the attacker is armed, it is ill-advised to attempt to resist an attack, instead saying to stay alert so as to better describe the attacker later. It gives advice on how to be aware of one's surroundings, instructing service members, for example, to ask for IDs of door-to-door salespeople, or to stay inside one's vehicle in case of an auto accident. In case of an attack, one suggestion is to roll under an automobile and scream loudly. The brochure suggests that people who might be victimized are young, naive, new to a base or installment, or emotionally unstable. Notable is the brochure's focus on victims rather than potential rapists as those responsible for prevention of sexual assault. Protect Our Defender spokesperson, speaking to Wired magazine, called the brochure an affront to victims and the latest in a long history of failed programs and policies. He suggested in addition to shifting the target of such pamphlets towards perpetrators rather than victims, reforms are needed to remove the chain of command from the process of reporting or investigating sexual crimes. In a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing this week, held as recent Department of Defense reports count 26,000 military sexual assaults in 2012, soon departing Air Force Secretary Michael Donnelly responded negatively to that idea in response to questioning by Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand.
Fiscal year 2011 had 19,000 cases of sexual assault and rape, 3,192 reported, 190 convictions. The fiscal year 2012 report has come up with higher numbers, 26,000 cases, and barely more reported, 3,374. Obviously, this is not good order and discipline. So are you saying that every commander in the chain of command is failing in our military today?
No, I'm not. And I would say that the changes in the numbers that we're seeing is a matter of some debate, and we're not really sure whether the numbers of increasing reporting reflect a higher incidence or they reflect more confidence in the system, so we're getting more reporting of incidents that had already been taking place in the
Secretary Donnelly, take the lower number. Let's not even take the supposed cases of 19,000. Let's just stick with the 3,000 reported cases. If that's too high for you, let's stick with 190 convictions from last year.
The numbers are too high. We agree with you on that. The issue is that you've asked about is whether or not commanders ought to be involved in this work. And I guess in my judgment, and I'll defer to the chief to chime in here, commanders need to be part of the good order and discipline for their units.
The idea of removing responsibility in sexual assault cases from the immediate chain of command has been a topic of congressional debate since, in March, an Air Force commander chose to overturn a guilty sexual assault conviction of an Air Force pilot and reinstate him to his post, choosing only to not promote him. In a press conference this week, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel addressed command climate in relationship to military sexual assault.
I'm directing service chiefs to develop methods to hold military commanders, all military commanders, accountable for establishing command climates of dignity and respect and incorporating sexual assault prevention and victim care principles in their commands. I'm directing the service secretaries to implement methods to improve victim treatment by their peers, coworkers, and chains of command. Direct victim input will also be incorporated into these methods. I'm directing that all commanders be provided the results of their subordinates' annual command climate surveys in order to enhance accountability and improve insight into command climate at every level of the chain of command.
While Hagel and other defense officials have resisted concretely taking authority in sexual assault cases from the chain of command, the most recent National Defense Authorization Act established a panel set to review military command's role in investigation and prosecution of sex crimes. This week's developments have been set against the backdrop of news reported by KABU earlier this week that Air Force Officer Jeffrey Krasinski, head of the service's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Unit, was arrested over the weekend for sexual assault. In light of the events of the past week, the White House is holding a bipartisan meeting today with several members of Congress to address the issue of military sexual assault. While the names of legislators included were not released, CNN reports that Senator Gillibrand, quoted earlier in this report, was one of those invited to participate.
In Pakistan, a court ruled today that the CIA drone strikes in the country are illegal. The court authorized the Pakistani government to use force, if necessary, to end the drone attacks. In addition, the court ordered the Pakistani government to gather information about the victims and offer compensation. Today's ruling comes just 2 days before elections in Pakistan, which will mark the first transition from one civilian government to another. The lawsuit was filed against the CIA by a Pakistani human rights organization in 2011 on behalf of over 30 civilians who were killed by a drone strike that targeted a gathering of tribal elders. The victims lost a lawsuit against the British government, which they are currently appealing, but the lawsuit in Pakistan marks a new stage in the tension between the U.S. government and its allies in Pakistan. After Saturday's election, the new Pakistani government will need to decide whether to enforce the ruling or appeal it to the Supreme Court.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, Afghan President Hamid Karzai has revealed new details on security talks with the U.S. government, announcing that the Afghan government may allow up to 9 U.S. bases to remain in the country following the scheduled withdrawal of NATO troops next year. While U.S. officials have declined to confirm details, U.S. embassy staff in Kabul expressed they were not interested in having bases in Afghanistan permanently. The U.S. may be hoping for a final agreement following months-long talks in time for a NATO summit this year, according to the BBC.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, May 9, 2013. Israeli soldiers attack a Palestinian village and demolish homes as settlers attack residents' cars. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers invaded on Thursday morning the Barta'a village near the northern West Bank city of Jenin, declared the village a closed military zone and demolished 12 shops. Ghassan Ubeda, head of the Barta'a village council, reported that the army invaded the village after sealing all of its entrances, declared it a closed military zone and demolished 12 structures. Ubeda added that 120 Palestinians work in the demolished buildings, and that most of them are the sole breadwinners in their families. Furthermore, soldiers handed military orders to 8 shop owners informing them the army will be demolishing their shops under the pretext that they were built without construction permits. Also on Thursday, Israeli soldiers invaded Idna town near the southern West Bank city of Hebron and Bab al-Zawiya area in the city, broke into and searched several homes. Local sources reported that large Israeli military force invaded Idna after closing all of its entrances,